Good morning. The subject of rainbows and clouds seems to keep coming up in my life as I drop my daughter off for college. I'm not sure if the song was chosen that way on purpose. It's probably a little egotistical of me to suggest that that was the case. But it is a blessing to live in a horrible world where horrible things happen, and to know that we are in the care of the one who provides the rainbow for us, who will give us joy and hope and peace and purpose in this life, and that welcomes us into fellowship with him. Fellowship with him is actually kind of the subject of the lesson this morning, or lessons, I should say. I'm going to preach three sermons for you here today. This morning, that is, and they'll be a little bit shorter than your average sermons, at least. All gravitating around the basic topic of dinner with the Lord. As is the case now, it was not an uncommon form of entertainment or hospitality in the day of Jesus to invite somebody over to your house. It was considered an honor to be asked, especially if the person giving the dinner was someone of note, someone of significance. And Jesus is invited over to dinner. And as is oftentimes the case, when you welcome Jesus into your heart and into your life, things don't necessarily go the way you expected them to go. And this dinner is very much like that. When Jesus is asked to dinner, on the way to dinner, he runs across a man with what the New American Standard Bible calls dropsy, a physical ailment, debilitating ailment, and Jesus knows the attitude of the Pharisees with regard to the healing on the Sabbath day. And so he asks them there, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? Would it be a good idea to heal this person today, given that it's the Sabbath day? And the preposterous notion of this question kind of jumps out and grabs us here. Would it be okay to do this wonderful thing for this wonderful person? If you had the ability to do it, would you do it? And they hesitate to give the obvious answer because it's exactly the opposite of what they've been telling him all this time. And Jesus heals the man, of course. And you have to wonder if maybe some of the people who were Jesus' quiet critics at this moment, who also were going to this dinner, might have thought at this occasion, well, this is going to be a really interesting dinner party that we have over this fellow's house. I wonder if Jesus is going to pull some of his stunts and say some of these crazy things that he's known for saying. Well, as it turns out, he did. And in fact, there's three basic parables that Jesus tells on this occasion. We're going to deal briefly with each of them. And they all have to do with dinner. And I hope it doesn't make everybody just extraordinarily hungry today. And the overriding theme here with regard to this dinner is that we have this tendency, when we are welcomed into fellowship, whether it is in a private home or whether it's by the Lord, to think that it's all about us. This is about me. What an honor it is for me. What a great opportunity it is for me. I hope they serve something I like. I hope they invite people that I like. I hope that they have entertainment afterward that I like. Because if not, I'm going to regret coming to this dinner. And Jesus is going to try to get us to look at things from a different perspective, particularly with regard to the last parable. It is not about you. It is about the fact that you have been privileged to become a partaker in this invitation, that you are given an opportunity to eat with the Lord, as we just did a few moments ago, actually in literal form. And if we can break away from this notion of looking at these spiritual blessings about as being all about us and how we can advance ourselves and how we can make ourselves a little bit more important and think more in terms of what the Lord is doing for us and what we in turn can do for other people, for us to learn our place in things in a putting ourselves down sort of sense. You know, finding your place oftentimes may seem like we want to be important. And what Jesus is trying to do is not to make us feel unimportant, but to make us feel that we are not the center of the universe. And sometimes we need to be told that. that this is an opportunity when you come to presence into the presence of the Lord for you to become less than you were. And in so doing, ironically, and in a twisted sort of logic, becoming more than you possibly could have imagined. Especially with regard to this first story they're going to deal with. We read earlier from verses 7 through 11, and we won't take time to reread this again. But the notion here of seeking the higher seats, this is a cultural norm that does not reflect all that well in the modern day. But I think close enough, at least. Well, we understand that there are places where the important people sit, and there are places where the somewhat less important people sit, and there are places, you know, there's standing room only, you know, for all the rest of it. If you are given a good table at a wedding, or if you are given a seat on the dais at some kind of promotion, big dinner, or gala event, or whatever, there are certain places where obviously the important people are sitting. And they did not have, as far as we can tell anyway, place cards, name cards back then. You just kind of grab whatever seat you get. And so the tendency oftentimes was to sit in the important seats because we consider ourselves to be important people. And surely I'm more worthy of this good seat than this slacker over here who seems to be having his eye on it. And if I can get there first, then I can have it and he can go down to this lower place where he deserves to be. It's an exercise in ego. It's an opportunity for us to vaunt ourselves. And Jesus suggests that we go the other way. And this is told, given to us as a parable, the text says here. I think there is some good social etiquette advice that's seen here. But there's more to it than that. This is not just a way to keep yourself from embarrassing yourself at dinner. You can use it that way and use it to your advantage, and that's great. But there's more important lessons going on here. Jesus is not just teaching us how to know our place at dinner. He's teaching us how to know our place in life. It's a lesson in humility, basically what we're talking about here. We find honor at the Lord's table by not seeking honor. That's kind of a weird twist, and Jesus is full of these things. The notion here that we would exalt ourselves by doing everything in our power to keep from exalting ourselves would seem to be counterintuitive. And I guess it is counterintuitive. But what it really is doing is it is ceding the power. I am more comfortable controlling my own destiny, choosing my own seat, deciding for myself how important I am going to be in this life. Problem with that is, I don't have complete power with regard to such things. In some situations, I have remarkably little power. And it very well may be that in my making myself important, I wind up humiliating myself. Now, you're not entitled to that. You're going to have to take whatever's left over. There isn't anything left over. Well, that's a shame. But you can't have the seat you have. So you can go stand in the corner or leave or whatever. And then you embarrass yourself. You've done it to yourself. Because you controlled the power of how much honor you were going to get. And you messed things up. Jesus says you have to give that power to me. I will decide how important you are. And that's where faith comes in. How much faith do you have with regard to allowing Jesus to determine how important you are? The person who's not of humble spirit is not going to be able to do this. The person who doesn't have faith is not going to be able to do this. But if you believe that Jesus is honorable, if you believe that Jesus is right, if you believe that Jesus has your best intentions in mind, that your future is best placed in his hands, you can simply throw up your hands and say, Lord, you seat me wherever you want to seat me. Doesn't matter to me. Pardon me. I will go wherever you want to go. Sneeze however many times you have to sneeze. And it's okay. Because I trust in you. Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse number 6 and 7, that we are supposed to trust in the Lord's exaltation. Allow Him to exalt us. I like the way he phrases it here, and I'll read his words. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 6 and 7. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety on Him, because He cares for you. Now, there's at least a couple of sermons right there in that little passage right there. We'll touch the high points here. Humble yourselves, he says, that He, God, may exalt you at the proper time. The proper time may not be right now. In fact, I'll almost guarantee it's not right now. That doesn't really work for me. I want to be exalted now. I want to do the things that will take care of me and make me look important and significant now, in my way, in my time. And the Lord asks me to wait. Why? Well, I'm not sure I know exactly why. I can tell you a little bit about why. Because maybe I'm not the most patient person in the world. Maybe my faith is not all that it could be. Maybe God has given me a chance to exercise here. Maybe I am taking too much on myself. Maybe my concerns, my worries about this life have not really been handed over to the Lord. If I am not important enough in this life, I'm not going to be able to get through life's bumps. I'm not going to be able to weather the storms that life brings me. And so until I get that level of importance, that level of achievement, of accomplishment, of credit, notoriety in this life, I'm going to be ill-equipped to handle what the life has. Well, let's deal a further blow to our egos here. I would offer to you that you are never going to be up for it. That you're never going to be completely equipped to handle the hardships and difficulties of life. But God is. And so we're trying to play the long game here. We're trusting in God. Instead of trusting in ourselves and doing the best we can, we're trusting in God because we believe that God can handle all of it. So we cast all our anxieties on Him. And we do it with confidence because we know that He cares for us. He wants us to be exalted. He wants us to be successful. This is not humiliation in the way that we generally use the word. He's not humbling us simply so that we will be forced to grovel, so we will look embarrassed, humiliated in front of our friends and neighbors and enemies. He is humbling us so we will be in position to accept and appreciate the exaltation that He has in mind for us in due course of time. Now, if you do not want to do that, if you are going to resist that, if you're going to push back from that, you should be prepared for some bad news, as the guests in this story did receive the news. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall, the text says in Proverbs 16, verse 18. Very important lesson. We all know egotists. We all know people who think very, very highly of themselves. And there's a part of us that gets a little bit of a chuckle, a rather perverse thrill, we have to admit, when this person gets taken down a peg. And we have all kinds of expressions for that. You know, they had to, you know, had their ego taken down a notch a little bit. Well, that happens sometimes in life. Maybe not as often as we'd like, and maybe to us more often than we would care for. But it does happen. And we're warned here. The more control you take over your future, the more control you take over your life, the more insistent you are upon holding onto the reins yourself, refusing to hand them over to God, the more you set yourself up for disappointment and for failure. And again, it's obviously a faith exercise to be willing to do this. But we have to find a way to do it. There's a passage in the book of Amos that I'd like to refer you to here. When people... Well, let's generalize here for a second. The people that we hope get their comeuppance in due course of time. They are typically the ones who got where they are at somebody else's expense, usually at our expense. People who used us as rungs in life's ladder, and we didn't especially care for it. We may have said as much. They may have laughed at us. And perhaps we kind of shook our fists in the air and said, "You're going to get yours one of these days." You know, there's this notion of karma that comes from the East. The idea that the universe balances. That the good things and the bad things in life kind of come to a stability over the course of time. The universe corrects itself, as it were. It's a pagan notion. It is not found in the Bible. Please resist the notion of, well, you know, there is karma in the world. No, there's not karma in the world. There's God in the world. And God does have his sense of justice. God does have his sense of right and wrong. And he accomplishes that in life. But not as consistently as we would like. Not as regularly as we would like. Not on command. That being said, God does warn those who achieve at other people's expense. The ones who dine in the pleasure palaces, the ivory palaces here. In verse number 4 of Amos chapter 6, those who recline on beds of ivory and spread sprawl on their couches and eat lambs from the flock and calves from the midst of the stall, who improvise to the sound of the harp and like David have composed songs for themselves, who drink wine from the sacrificial bowls while they anoint themselves with the finest of oils, yet they have not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. Therefore, they will now go into exile at the head of the exiles, and the sprawlers banqueting will pass away. A little background here. The nation of Israel, the northern kingdom, after the split in the days of Jeroboam II, is doing very, very well. It's a prosperous time and has been for a certain period of time. Ahab was a very successful king, even more than his father was, and ushered in a certain time of prosperity in the nation that God permitted, despite the fact that since very early days, really since the days of Jeroboam the first, the nation had drifted further and further away from the true worship of the true Heavenly Father. And these ones, some of them anyway, who had prospered greatly, had done so not just in rebellion against God's will, but in rebellion against common decency. Although they were doing very well, others were not. And they did not look at the spiritual plight of the nation or the economic plight of certain ones who were disadvantaged. They were only concerned about their own beds of ivory. They were only concerned about their own comfort level. And God tells them, there is judgment coming for these things. It is sure. And if you choose not to make your life right, then you are going to be run under God's wheels. It takes humility to accept that. It takes humility for us to accept a role of service and to realize that in this society where we always want to take care of ourselves and emphasize taking care of number one and being successful and comfortable and all that, it's a very difficult lesson to learn, this notion that you serve yourself the best by serving other people. It is counterintuitive. And to a certain degree, maybe some people out there in the world get a nice thrill when they do some charity work or whatever. It makes you feel good, and then you go back to your selfish lifestyle. That's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about doing a good thing every once in a while to appease your conscience. We're talking about serving on an ongoing basis every day of your life, serving God first, serving others second, serving yourself last. That is how you truly give yourself a leg up in life. That's what Jesus did himself. He is the one who came to this world not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. He is the one who serves more than anybody does. And there's a remarkable text given to us here in Luke chapter 12 and verse 37 and 38, which almost runs exactly the opposite of other things that Jesus has said about service, and about him as the Lord, and us as the ones who are serving him. Verse 37 says, "Blessed are those slaves whom the master will find on the alert when he comes. Truly I say to you, that he will gird himself to serve and have them recline at the table and will come up and wait on them. That's a weird thing. Slaves being served by the master. Whether he comes in the second watch or even in the third and finds them so, blessed are those slaves. Wouldn't it be marvelous if we spent our lives in service, humbling ourselves before our neighbors, before our brethren, before our Lord, and were found in that day of judgment, in that day of reckoning, in the role of service, and our Lord put himself at our disposal, and he gave us service? It's almost too much to ask for or to contemplate. And yet Jesus promises that this will be the case. For the one who humbles himself, he who humbles himself will be exalted. That's lesson one. Now it moves on from that, talking about hospitality. And I meant to change the verses on that, I apologize. But start reading with me in verse number 12. And he also went on to the one who had invited him. When you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors. Otherwise, they will invite you in return, and that will be your repayment. But when you give a reception, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you'll be blessed, since they do not have the means to repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. There may be no passage in the Scripture that we so flagrantly violate as this one. I'm not saying it's a sin for you to have your friends over for dinner. I'm not saying it's a sin for you to accept their return invitation. In fact, I will say that it's not a sin to do that. I will say this. If you are in the habit of socializing with your friends, showing generosity to your friends, extending yourself to your friends, and that's it, you don't understand Bible hospitality. That is not what the Bible means by hospitality. When we read in the New Testament about being hospitable people, it's not about being friendly with your friends. Jesus says so in so many words right here in this passage. This is not about tit for tat. This is not about extending an invitation to the really, really cool people so you'll get invited to the really, really cool place and the really cool parties. It's not about making friends so you'll have friends. That's not what this is. This is about service. This is about extending yourself to people who are not helping you and who very likely will not help you because they may not be able to help you. Hospitality is a duty that's given to us. It is not a deal that we work out in advance, implicitly or explicitly, with our neighbors. This is not a bargain. This is not a trade-off, as it were. We are serving because we are servants. That's what we do. We're not serving because there's something in it for us. We're not serving because there's some kind of back-end deal that we get, because all the cool people are serving these days. That's not it. I've heard about people who, in Hollywood, who will join Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous and go to all these meetings. So they'll meet all these Hollywood big shots that are recovering and be in position to make deals that ordinary people won't make deals. They don't drink, or certainly they don't expect, you know, have any perceived problem with drinking or drugs. They're not in it for the obvious reasons. They have ulterior motives in mind. I think that's kind of twisted, personally. Why are you serving? Are you serving because you found a way to serve that's fun? There are people that I socialize with in the Lord's church because I enjoy their company. I'm not going to apologize for that. That's a good thing. Jesus had best friends. I don't see why I can't have best friends. That being said, I don't consider myself to be adept at hospitality because I've had my best friends over to my house 6 times this year. That's not what hospitality is. That's having a good time, which is fine, but it's not hospitality. Hospitality is extending yourself because you are in position to do so, because Jesus himself did so, because this is the example that we are given to follow. Matthew chapter 20, verse 26 and following. It is not this way among you, the idea of lording it over your neighbors, he says. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall become your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to serve, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. This attitude of service that we choose to accept, that has no quid pro quo, that has no short-term benefit for us, no plan that's going to work itself out, no agenda other than our efforts to please God and serve him. It's an opportunity. It's not a chore. I suppose that I ought to like half a loaf better than I do. There are Christians, I'm not talking about anybody specific here, but you know this to be the case. There are Christians who have to be dragged, kicking, and screaming into doing the right thing. Right? It's sad. And every once in a while it works. And instead of being content and happy with that, I get aggravated that they're doing it for the wrong reason. Maybe that's not realistic for me. Maybe that's not an exercise in a peace on my part. But allow me to indulge a little bit here. Yes, it is a good thing for you to be a servant. It is a good thing for you to extend yourself, for you to offer yourself for the blessing of others and lift them up. And if you manage to get that far, God bless you for that. But allow me to present this not as something that you have to do, but rather something that you get to do. It is a blessing to be put in position to serve. Jesus does not present service as a drudgery. He presents it as an opportunity for us. He took delight in serving us, just as he took delight in washing the feet of the disciples on that day, that evening before his crucifixion in John chapter 13. And then turns around and says, do you understand what I've done for you? What I've done for you, you also do for others. You do for each other. And this is one of the two occasions where Jesus gives this remarkable statement about how a servant is not greater than his master. Well, what's that supposed to mean? Whoever claimed that a servant was greater than his master? I'll tell you who did. You did. And I did. When we said the lifestyle that Jesus adopted for himself is too lowly, too base, too undignified for us, we said on that day, a servant's greater than his master. If Jesus took delight in service, we need to find a way to take delight in service in him. Not simply do it out of necessity. Now, if you've got to start there, start there. But allow yourself to grow. Allow yourself to develop true commitment to the Lord, true commitment to your brethren, and find the joy there that Jesus found there. Look at hospitality as an investment instead of an expense. You know, they say that you have to spend money to make money. I'm not sure exactly how true that is, but I think that's probably generally speaking true. If you want to profit somehow, you're going to have to put yourself out there. You're going to have to expend something. And it may be that you find hospitality to be too big of an expense. And we're not really talking about money here, although money sometimes comes into it. From a practical standpoint, money's usually involved with entertaining and with hospitality and such. but not necessarily money. Mainly we're talking about time here and emotion, a little pride maybe. Being willing to go to somebody and offer yourself to them. That is an expenditure of important resources that you and I may not be prepared to expend. But perhaps we would be more willing to do so if we saw it not as an expense, but as an investment. To realize that we are not just spending time and spending energy and spending money. We are investing resources in heaven. We are investing resources in spiritual things. And I'm not saying here that if you do enough good to enough people and spend enough money, that means you're going to go to heaven. That's not what I mean by investing in spiritual resources here. I'm suggesting this, that the more invested you get in spiritual things, the more committed you get to spiritual causes, the more connected you become to Jesus, the more connected you become to the things of Jesus, the more your heart goes where your treasure has already gone. That's what Jesus says, right, about storing up treasures in heaven instead of on the earth. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. If you want to love service, if you want to love serving, if you want to love hospitality, invest yourself in hospitality. Put your treasure there. More than you're comfortable with. I think at the end of the day, you're going to find that your heart's going to be there also. You'll wind up loving the lifestyle that you've chosen because you've chosen it so firmly and so completely, so wholeheartedly. One other lesson, and I didn't change the verse again. Apologize for that. But let's pick up the reading in verse number 29. I'm looking at the wrong passage. I apologize. Back to Luke chapter 14. Let's start in verse number 15. When those who were reclining at the table with him heard this, he said to them, "Blessed is everyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God." But he said to him, a man was giving a big dinner, and he invited many. And at the dinner hour, he sent his slaves to those who had been invited, "Come, for everything is ready now." But they all alike began to make excuses. The first one said to him, "I've bought a piece of land, and I need to go and look at it. Please consider me excused." Another one said, "I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I am going to try them out. Please consider me excused." Another one said, "I have married a wife, and for that reason I cannot come." And the slave came back and reported this to his master. Then the head of the household became angry. And he said to his slave, "Go out at once into the streets and lanes of the city and bring in here the poor and crippled and blind and lame." And the slave said, "Master, what you commanded has been done, and still there is room." And the master said to the slave, "Go out into the highways and along the hedges and compel them to come in so that my house will be filled. For I tell you that none of those men who were invited shall taste of my dinner." Third dinner analogy, third dinner parable is a lesson in priorities. And what we're talking about here is deciding whether or not you're going to come to dinner with the Lord. Whether or not you respect the gesture. Do you understand what it means when the Lord offers you an opportunity to come to His table, to dine with Him, to have fellowship with Him, spend time with Him, commune with Him? And we could be talking about the Lord's table as we did earlier this morning. We could be talking about fellowship in a general sense. Every day of your life, spending in the company of the Lord. What a marvelous thing that is. Or not. Yeah, maybe that's not your thing. Maybe you're not into that. Now, see, I got real estate holdings. That's what's holding my attention right now. It's not that I disrespect the Lord. It's not that I'm not interested in dinner. I'm interested. I just got other stuff going on. You know, I got livestock to handle. Business doesn't take care of itself. You know, I gotta keep my, your shoulder to the wheel, your nose to the grindstone, whatever it is. Whatever it is, you have to keep on the other thing. That's what I got to do because this is life. This is real. I got married, you know. Clearly, I can't come to the Lord. I can't come to dinner because I got married. That's the one that's always kind of puzzled me a little bit. There are people who refuse fellowship because of their marriage. And I won't get into a big discussion about this, but there are discussions that are held, they're being held today probably, with elders all over the world, with people who are very interested in serving the Lord. They've read their Bible, they want to be in fellowship with God, they want to be in fellowship with God's people, they want to be in fellowship with those God's people. And the subject of marriage comes up, and we find out that according to the Bible, they don't have a right to their wife, or they don't have a right to their husband. And they say, well, I am married. I'll stick with my marriage. I'll stick with my wedding. And not come to fellowship. Well, you made your choice. It's a matter of priorities. I spent a lot of time thinking about priorities lately. I'll probably do a whole lesson on priorities before too long. Don't want to spoil the ending for too much of it here. But I'll suggest to you that every issue that you have, every barrier that you have, every challenge that you face with regard to your fellowship with the Lord basically comes down to priorities. Do you respect what God has done for you? Do you understand how much of an honor it is to be brought to the table? You know, all the nominees for the various awards are like 1,000 of them now, and they always say, well, it's just, I don't really care whether I win or not, it's just an honor to be nominated. Well, that's ridiculous, of course. They don't mean that. We don't expect that they mean that, and maybe that's okay. But it really is an honor to be nominated, to be offered the invitation to come and be at the table. What a marvelous blessing that is, considering who we are and what we've been through. The Apostle Paul describes himself as being the chief of sinners, and that God showed mercy to him anyway. And he found grace in Jesus Christ. 1 Timothy chapter 1, 15 through 17. He was given this opportunity. So were you, despite your background. Me, despite my background. Maybe if we understood what it means to come to dinner with the Lord, maybe we'd be more inclined to accept the invitation. We need to adjust the plan. If you are not a Christian, I tailor most of my lessons to those who are already in the faith, but there are others, obviously, in the world, and maybe you're one of them, who is not a Christian, but you're contemplating it, maybe. Maybe I should be doing this. Maybe I should be giving myself to the Lord. Let me pop the bubble for you here a little bit. Not to discourage you in any way, but to help you realize something. There are going to be plans that you have in mind right now that are going to have to change if you come to the Lord. It's almost impossible for that not to be the case. There are Christians, in fact, who in their life of faith have established certain plans for their life. And maybe they didn't intend to rebel against God. Maybe they didn't intend to reject Jesus' invitation. But that's what they've done. They consider themselves to be grateful honorees. But they're going to have to distance themselves from the Lord a little bit because they have something going on in their life that at least temporarily is interfering. Are we willing to adjust our plans? I bought some land. I need to go check it out. Check it out later. Check it out another day. Check it out in the next 10 minutes and get back. Or don't check it out. If you care about coming to dinner, you're going to come to the dinner. It's a priorities thing. Well, I got oxen I got to check out. Same thing. Check them out later. Check them out earlier. Don't check them out. Don't buy them at all. Whatever it takes. If you care more about your oxen than you care about your dinner, that's one thing. But if you care more about the dinner, you're going to make the plan with the oxen fit. Or not fit, as the case may be. Maybe you have to jettison the oxen. Or the wife even. The plan that we are making with the Lord The plan that we are invited to partake of with the Lord, bottom line, is more important than anything else that's going on in our life. Do we believe that? Do we really believe that? This is the number one priority for the rest of your life. Nothing is ever going to be this important. Would we do what the fishermen did in Matthew chapter 4? Follow me. I'll make you fishers of men. Okay. Boom. Quit my job. Drop my things. Not even going to pack a lunch. I'm just going to go. What an amazing gesture of faith that is. And a sign of commitment, real commitment. I don't know what the future holds, but I'm going to be with the Lord, and I trust the Lord's going to take care of me. Now, they weren't always consistent with their faith, usually around lunchtime, right? What are we going to eat? That's what they're always talking about. What are we going to eat? And then the Lord miraculously feeds them. And then a couple of weeks later, what are we going to eat? What are we going to eat? Do you realize that if you come to dinner with the Lord, you're never going to be hungry again? Do you realize that? That all of your needs, your real needs, not your wants necessarily, but all of your needs, all of your really important issues are handled in Jesus. Seek first His kingdom, He says, and all these things will be added to you. All these things doesn't mean millions and millions of dollars. Doesn't mean a convertible sports car and trip to wherever you want to go. And that doesn't necessarily mean that. But you will be provided for if you will make His plan your only plan. And whatever plan you may have that interferes, put that to the side. Pursue Jesus and only Jesus. And seize the opportunity to do so. While it remains, it does not necessarily linger indefinitely. One of the problems living in a relatively stable society like ours, where we have all the blessings that we have, is that we kind of assume we're going to wake up tomorrow and nothing's going to change. Because after all, we woke up today and nothing changed. We've been doing it for 50 plus years and nothing's changed. Well, surely it's going to keep going like this for a while. Well, you know what? Maybe it will. And God be praised if that's the case. That's not a given by any means. The Roman Empire lasted half a millennium, but it fell. America will fall too, one of these days. If history teaches us anything, it teaches us that. And with it, all these rights that you have come to take for granted, that I've come to take for granted. You know, I cringe a little bit when I hear American Christians fussing and complaining about the future, about how, you know, if we were forced to take a stand in favor of such and such depravity or such and such sin and all the, if we don't toe the party line, we could get our tax-exempt status taken away from us. Like, that's the worst thing the devil has to throw at us. Like, that's the worst thing the devil is throwing at Christians now. We might have to pay money out of the church treasury to that big old mean federal government. That might mean I have to give more. Oh, I can't have that. Trust me. I'm not a prophet or the son of the prophet, but it can very easily get much, much, much worse than that. But instead of worrying about that, why don't instead we take advantage of the opportunities that are in front of us right this very minute? Isaiah 55, verse 6, "Seek the Lord while He may be found. Call upon Him while He is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return to the Lord, and He will have compassion on him and to our God, for He will abundantly pardon." The implication being, of course, that God is not always going to be near. He is not always going to be in position to be found. And this has implications, of course, far beyond the rise and fall of nations. This has to do with your own personal health. your own personal position in life and the position of mankind in general. The circumstances that have been given to you in this life have brought you to this moment, and now you have a chance to accept God's invitation. You can do it now. You may or may not be able to do it tomorrow. Just because you have spurned 1,000 invitations in your life doesn't mean you're going to get 1,000 more, or 100 more, or one more. So Jesus offers you to come. And we talk about extending the invitation sometimes, and that's what we mean. The Lord's invitation to dinner. You have a chance to be right with God. You have a chance to come home, to dine with Him, and with all of the faithful of all of the ages. Come to me, Jesus says, all who are weary and heavy laden, I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, humble in heart. And you'll find rest to your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Learn how to be humble. Learn how to serve. Learn how to submit from the Lord who gave Himself for us. That is the opportunity that is yours, that is ours, this very day. I would strongly urge you, as you consider your salvation today, to make your life right with God, to come to dinner. Whatever is causing you to reject His invitation, put it aside and accept His offering now. Bring Christ your broken life. Whatever is going wrong in your life, Jesus is there for you. Jesus loves you. Jesus died for you. And He invites you into His home, into His family, into His fellowship. Please allow us to help in whatever we possibly can while together we stand and sing at this time.